Hello, friends, and welcome to Hello, Friend. My name is Bethany Rutter, and today's friend is, well, it's actually two people. For the first time ever, I have two friends in the studio. They are Brad Clark and Philip O'Mara. I wanted to talk to them about two things I'm really passionate about, food and dating. But first, I'm going to have to ask this in two parts. Phil, how do we know each other? And Brad, how do you and Phil know each other?
We know each other because we met on OkCupid.
Yes, we did.
We dated.
Yeah.
Yeah, a few times.
I guess you can call it that.
Yeah. And yeah.
And we are still here today in the studio.
Yeah, yeah, that's
still
good.
Alive.
And Brad, how do you and Phil know each other?
I met Phil through a very popular gay dating app.
Which one? Name Not names.
Grindr.
The most popular one.
The most popular one.
Cool.
Probably for all the wrong reasons, but it's the most popular one.
I think they're probably all the right reasons.
Yeah, yeah, one at the time for sure.
I can't decide if we should start with the food part or the internet dating part. But let's start with the food part, because that's why I want both of you here. Because
sure.
You run a cool business. Tell
Yay.
Me about it.
Basically, we've been talking about, like, I mean, we both like cooking and we both like food, of course, in general. And we've been talking about doing like this food business that could have been like a market store or something else. And I finally made a move at the end of the last year. And yeah, I went to this program called NEA with a... It's a scheme, program.
The job centre. It's a new enterprise allowance.
New enterprise allowance.
Yeah.
Cool.
And yeah, we started working on a business plan and what we wanted to sell. And we, what we do is food from my region, where I'm from in Italy. And the main dish is called frico, which is a very cheesy... it's very simple, really. It's like potatoes, cheese, and onions.
And you can put like other junk in it as well, right? Like,
yeah, we are personalized.
Seasonal,
I mean, we're creating new recipes. We had one with sweet potatoes, one with cauliflower at the moment.
I think that's the one that I had.
Tell me the names.
Yeah. We play a lot with names because we like that. And
because we're Drag Race fans.
Because we're Drag Race
fans. Puns are everywhere. Secret, hidden, kind of small little jokes and so, nudge, nudge,
stealth
wink,
puns.
Wink. Yeah, exactly.
The cauliflower one is called Californication. And we have also butternut squash gnocchi. And they're called Butterface, which comes from Drag Race.
Yeah,
like,
but
she
her
has
face.
A hot body, but her face.
So the origin of it was you'd always wanted to do this thing, and then you found like a way that enabled you to do it.
Yeah, it was
the
a bit kind of
came.
A very like last minute decision, because I was there with Brad at the office. And I was actually, I wanted to kind of do the graphic design thing, like properly doing like as a self-employed and do everything like by the rules and that. And then at the last minute, I changed my mind and I said, you know what, we should try that.
And try the food thing.
Yeah, like literally last minute we were there and I changed. You know what, I just put like
haven't food talked store. To me about it at all.
Oh, like, you've gone for the NEA thing for a different
for a different
purpose.
Thing, yeah.
Oh my God, how cool.
That's it. I feel it's not the right thing and we should do something else.
Cool. Yeah. And like, Brad, you're really good at cooking anyway. And like,
thanks.
You're very like passionate about it. And I love following you on the gram and seeing all of your food creations.
Yeah.
So it seems like a natural fit. And like, Phil, you're a pretty good cook too.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're almost as good as me.
It's been like a thing I learned quite late. Actually, because I've always been very spoiled when I was a kid.
Auntie. Yeah, I was going to say, didn't your aunt kind of, your aunt
yeah,
and your
my
mom
auntie, hey, she is like an amazing...
She's everybody's auntie.
She's an amazing cook. And well, basically, all I learned almost all I learn, and the food I'm selling as well comes from what I learned from her.
And this is in the kind of north of Italy near the Alps, is that right?
Yeah. It's very mountainy place. It's near Austria, very close to Austria, very close to Slovenia as well. So there are loads of influences from foreign countries. I mean, it's been an area which has always been like between different like empires, and so it's quite unique, really. It's not very known.
Yeah, it's not like the kind of typical Italian Mediterranean cooking.
No, definitely. Well, the region came, it's quite famous for wines, because it's a very good area for wines. But the food we're serving, I mean, frico, most of the Italian people don't know what it is.
Yeah.
It's very, very typical and regional. But, everybody likes it. It's quite impossible.
How could
not
you not
to
like it?
Unless you really don't like it, I don't know.
We did have one German lady who was very, very odd. She tried it and then she just changed her mind halfway through, and we were both very offended by it.
But had she paid for it already?
Yeah, and she wanted her money back.
So. Absolutely not.
Okay, fine.
Under what circumstances would you give someone their money back?
If they were very, very, very nice and polite, and a very good excuse.
I feel like someone who was
actually,
very
I'm allergic
nice.
To onion. Oh. Okay, then you can have the money back.
Even though we visibly list all of the ingredients.
Oh, we've learned that signs mean nothing.
What?
People just don't read anything.
No.
It's because they're so busy looking at you two.
I mean, we even have as one of the ingredients tears of joy. And every time someone says, oh, what's that? Is that herb? And you're like, no.
It's like the new superfood, didn't you know?
And it has a little asterisk saying, the tears of joy are actually your own, not ours, kind of for hygiene reasons.
You are
on a Brick Lane market on Sundays.
Yeah.
What is the process of like getting on there?
It was quite easy, actually. I think when we both started, we thought it would be like a 6-month waiting list and then having to jump through lots of hoops. And actually, it was very, very simple. There was no waiting list. We just emailed the market office for Tower Hamlets. And there's this lady there called Sue. It's quite an experience when you meet Sue. they basically just look at your food, and if they think that it fits, I think they're trying to avoid duplication. You get like 20 burger joints or whatever. As they like it and they don't think it clashes with anything else, they just grant you a license, and it's just £12 every 6 months.
That's pretty decent.
Yeah, and then you just pay a daily pitch of about 38 quid. It depends on where in the market you are, but and it's pretty simple. We both had to do a hygiene certificate, which is just online, really quick and easy.
Cool. So I guess by virtue of like, I guess anyone can do it, but it helps if what you're serving is kind of unusual.
Yeah, I think you need to find a hook, basically. It needs to be something quirky, and it can be even just the branding. As long as something about it is different, then I don't think you have a problem. But if it's just another kind of burger,
standard burger
bar or something,
standard,
then it probably won't
be approved. Japanese. Cool. Yeah.
Actually, we didn't want to go to Brick Lane
first.
We were kind of scared because neither of us had like experience with markets serving food. So we didn't want to go. And when we spoke to Sue,
she said,
we can start in Brick Lane. We have like a few pitches.
We both looked at each other with horror in our eyes.
And she was like, someone could tell you, it's okay. I mean, you're going to make it. But
she's basically
the mother goose
of Tower Hamlets.
Yeah. She said that, and the moment it worked, it was like, why are we worrying so much? I mean, just do it.
I think because we both previously went to Brick Lane a lot as just visitors, and it can be an overwhelming place. It's very, very busy, and it has lots of interesting characters. And so we just had in our mind that it would be a nightmare to work there.
Yeah.
The reality is a lot different to what we thought it would be. It's a lot easier than that.
Yeah. And are people generally like nice to you?
Yeah. I mean, actually, I think because our food is quite different and it's vegetarian too, so I think you get a totally different crowd anyway.
Not like meat bros.
No. You sometimes see couples come up and one of them's like, I really want it. And the other one's like, but there's no meat. And you can see like they're torn between the deliciousness of our food, because it is delicious.
It's really delicious.
But then thinking, but I really want something with meat in it. And then you just think, oh, just I don't know, by both, and have someone yeah. each. But yeah, so it's funny. You get to see kind of all types of people there.
So you serve like three main things, right? You serve frico, gnocchi, and polenta.
Yeah, the polenta goes with the frico, which is how we eat it in Friuli, and the place where I come from. And
when he mentioned polenta at first, I was like, no way. It's disgusting.
Yeah.
Were you thinking of like the slimy polenta rather than the
Spanish style polenta that's just like, what is that? It's meant to be like mashed potatoes, but it's not.
No, the process is like kind of formed into like a
cake. It's basically a more like firm and solid, and then we grill it, we fry it, and so you get also the kind of chalky.
It basically
tastes
like solid popcorn that's kind of roasted. It's a really nice flavour.
Yeah. Well, the traditional way we cook it in Italy is on a fire stove, like for an hour. It's like a very long process. You have to kind of stir it, and then you get like this dome of polenta, which is already basically solid. You don't have to wear, but it's different from region to region, because frico is very typical from a region, but polenta is all northern Italian dish. So every region has its. They cook it also with like cheese in it or veggies, and it's
amazing really how many people don't know what it is, though. It's like almost every other person asks, "What is that?
What's polenta?"
That?
Yeah, that's really interesting.
I think corn hasn't really ever taken off
as a grain.
It's always been like a foreign thing.
Yeah,
sweet corn is about as close as we get over here, but yeah, in Europe it's everywhere. But
I guess I didn't even know that's what polenta was.
Oh.
I just knew it was tasty
cornmeal.
Yeah, it's funny also seeing how I made a dish, it's seen like very differently. It depends on where you are. I mean, here it's probably seen somewhere like a fancy thing,
yeah,
like polenta, you know,
this
thing with polenta. And for me, it's like it's bread.
Yeah,
it's
like the standard
thing.
Like accompaniment to...
Yeah,
like
it was like, it was really like the food of poor people, because it was cheap. And
it's their baked beans.
And it gives you, it's very filling.
And you can you can do it in big quantities.
Yeah, then you can keep it. Yeah. You can go on for days. Yeah.
But so we talked about frico, we talked about polenta. The third item that I have eaten from your establishment is your delicious gnocchi.
Yeah.
It's so good. And you do it with like butter and sage.
Yeah, it's butternut squash gnocchi, which is...
No potatoes
involved. It's
again, it's another thing like polenta that when he first talked about it, I was like, I'm not sure. I've had gnocchi before and it was disgusting.
Not made by people, though.
No, it's the horrible stuff that you buy in the supermarket that's like kind of bullets. They never, ever soften. And they're always raw in the middle. And I was just like, why do you want to sell that?
Why do you want to inflict that upon people?
And then I tasted it. I was like, okay, this is not what I tasted.
It's really good.
Yeah, we call it a gnocchi di zucca, which is with squash and pumpkin. So they are yellow and... Yeah, we serve it like the typical, like traditional way with butter and sage and smoked cheese. And it gives you this. It's very, very comforting food.
Yeah.
It's really soft and silky and warming. It's like velvet.
I knew it was going to be nice because I remember like once you made me some kind of pasta with like butter and sage and like some cheese. Like, I think you maybe just been home or your brother had or something, and
there was
some kind of delicious cheese around.
That probably was it. The smoked ricotta.
Yeah.
We use that in Italy, but we like to use one of the things about this project is trying and mix the two cultures. And some like people from my region are like, oh, you're making like frico with cheddar cheese. It's like, how dare you? Because it's like
passport,
it's usually
ripped up upon entry.
It's usually like a specific like cheese called Montasio, and it does have a flavor. I mean, like a specific unique flavor. But frico is really, it was still a food of the poor, and I don't think they would have, like, they wouldn't have been bothered by the cheese they use.
Yeah.
Was really, initially was just melted cheese.
It's been 19 months mature.
Yeah. The leftovers. They didn't waste anything. So that's how it's created.
And speaking of waste, you seem to not have any because you always seem to sell out, right?
Yeah.
You're doing good. Like, that's really impressive.
Yeah.
What have been, so that's like a really nice success, but have there been any like bumps in the road where you were I never thought about that? Like, what? So if someone is listening at home and is like, I'm really passionate about this style of cooking, I'd love to kind of make it more public-facing. What are the things that you think people should think about that maybe they don't think about?
I think you can't underestimate how important branding is. I think a lot of people just start, which is good. It's good to start with some kind of experience or whatever. But I think you need to get the branding right. And at first, I think we were talking about branding it specifically about the food that we were going to sell. So Frico would have been in the name or something like that. But once you start, you realise there are some things you can and can't do, and you might have to change your food, or you might have to change this, that, the other. So we made our brand, which is Sorry Not Sorry, to kind of be as flexible as possible so it could change with us. So if we change the food that we make, you don't have to go back and rebrand everything that you've spent hundreds of pounds on.
Yeah. And like
business cards and all that sort of stuff.
The kind of branding of your establishment, it doesn't have like Italian flag colours.
No, I mean, that was a very conscious decision, because when you walk down any market, you can see the Italian stores from a mile away, and it's all stereotypical kind of gingham tablecloths and flags everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, truly, it's not really even Italian food. It's Alpine food.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it doesn't really have an Italian identity. Like Phil said, most Italians
don't recognize
it at all.
Don't know it, And it's still, even the name, I mean, Sorry Not Sorry, is this merging the two cultures?
So yeah.
the apologetic versus the.
When I first met Phil, he was kind of a bit surprised about how much British people apologise for everything.
Yeah, we're kind of a permanently embarrassed neighbour.
I learned that.
And then, just through conversations like, well, Italians are never sorry for anything. So
it's
like they never apologise, even when they really have to. So I was like, okay, that's a name.
So branding is a thing that people should like think about ahead of launch.
Maybe you don't necessarily have to have it in place when you begin, because you can begin. I mean, we began with very, very basic setup, and you don't have to spend a huge amount of money. I think if you have about £500 to £800, that's enough to buy all the equipment that you need.
To do like the whole business?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we probably could have been a bit more frugal at the beginning. I think we were a bit too because we got the funding from the NEA. So we were just like, let's spend it all. But looking backwards, we're like, okay, we should have been a bit more conservative and not bought some stuff that we didn't need at the time. But yeah, you could definitely do it for about £500 to £800.
Yeah, buy maybe. I mean, we do have a kind of very minimal basic setup. We would like to kind of upgrade it. So if you have enough money to buy like a proper big gazebo, steady, heavy duty.
The gazebo is
because the market and the weather, especially in London, if you're on a outdoor market,
very unpredictable.
It's windy, and sometimes it's like we literally hold the gazebo,
one hand with a frying pan, and the other hand holding onto the roof.
Because that's something like I would never think about as like the gazebo is important. The gazebo is a fundamental part of the setup.
Another thing is that we don't have. We decided to go light. Because we don't use a car, and we all put all the stuff in a trolley, like a garden trolley.
And we walk it 1 mile from his flat.
Basically, walk from my flat in Whitechapel, and it's all there. So
it
has to be kind of it all fits, but at the same time, and the equipment is just what you need. So if we had like a bigger gazebo and like heavier. Tables or a griddle.
Probably have to drive.
It would be
a bigger job getting it there.
But we kind of are thinking about it. I mean, we are thinking about other places or what we could do with the business, because it's really still testing at the moment. We started in February, and we're not so popular there, we are established, or no, we can do whatever we want. Yeah. And we like to experiment both with food, and we are imagine what we do. Yeah.
And Brick Lane can be a very unpredictable place.
Yeah.
It doesn't follow any kind of format or kind of expectation.
Seasonal predictability.
No. It can be beautiful weather, and it can be dead, and it can be hailstorms and thunder and be the busiest day of your year. So it's completely unpredictable. And even on the days when it is very busy, it can sometimes be, I don't know, 80% tourists that don't actually want to buy any food. They're just there to take photos.
Yeah, and it's true.
And so it can be a bit overwhelming. So I think we're leaning towards maybe finding somewhere a bit more kind of officey, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Like for everyday
people.
Like
White Cross Street or something.
Yeah, exactly. Just so everyday officey people, I guess, who just have a quick lunch break, can grab something, and then we could probably have a shorter day and
yeah.
Sell all of our stuff mostly at lunchtime and then...
Yeah, we're thinking about other ideas as well, maybe like collaborate with places. We don't know already. I mean, we just started thinking about it, but maybe finding a place or places, different places where you can use the kitchens, it would be cool,
yeah.
You know, like for, just for a period.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like this month we have this food. I don't know if it exists really. I mean, we started researching. We are looking into it, but...
I just
cool.
thought one day that there must be coffee shops in London that have kitchens that they don't use. Coffee shops that literally just serve cake and coffee.
Yeah,
that
could
must
do
want
with
to
like,
make a little bit of money. They're paying rent for the space anyway.
Some savoury menu items that are
exactly.
delicious.
So even if it's just one or two days a week, so it's just like a weekly event thing, it's something, I guess.
So actually, yeah, if someone is listening
and
wants to collaborate with us.
So if anyone is listening and wants to get involved with two cool dudes making delicious Alpine food, now is your chance.
Goes or, really well with coffee.
Yeah, I bet it does. Or if you just want to buy it for yourself... Sorry Not Sorry appears at Sunday Brick Lane Market. Are you always in the spot that I saw you at, or
pretty
did your
much.
Spot move?
Yeah, there's a lot of rivalry about the spots there. You can sometimes get into kind of small...
Skirmishes
with the regulars and things, because it's the market inspector that places you, and everybody's supposed to wait for them to turn up, but they don't. So everyone just pitches up where they always pitch up. And so when the market inspector turns up, sometimes there's a bit of a
battle.
Bit of a barney between the neighbours and
so
the
you're
market.
Roughly generally around on the
yeah,
kind
yeah.
of
it's
bridge.
By Jack the Clipper, the hairdresser's there, just as the train bridge goes over Brick Lane.
Cool.
Yeah, right before the overground bridge.
Officially,
yeah.
It's called the food court, but it couldn't be less of a food court if you tried. It's just the street.
Yeah,
the
I would
street.
Have thought the food court was the indoor
no,
bit.
No, that's
exactly.
all private. That's all private.
Yeah, it's like,
oh,
yeah.
That's so interesting.
I know. So the council call it the food court, but it's just a part of
the street.
Main road. Yeah,
it's just the road.
Yeah, they're the two markets. The indoor ones are private.
I didn't know that. That's some insider intel.
I mean, that's the other thing about Brick Lane is there is a huge amount of competition. If you include those indoor places, there's probably 200-300 food places.
Yeah, because when I came to eat your food, I didn't know where you were, so I just kind of wandered around and like I looked in both of the food places first, and you weren't there, and I was like, oh, like that's weird. And then I found you.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time I went to Brick Lane, I didn't even know they had food on the street up, because most people don't even make it that far up Brick Lane; they're just tired before the time they get there. So yeah, it's a strange setup, but yeah, I imagine some kind of mall food court, you know, like
yeah.
The McDonald's on one side, KFC, all of
Nando's.
That. Yeah, exactly. But no, it's the food court is the street. So
cool.
Also, another thing to consider is, well, we already said that, but the weather, and especially if you're not indoors, you have to like consider that you might skip like a week or it depends on how many days you work, but. Always could be like rainy or like not the best
for
not
you
the best
to be
weather
outside
too. Yeah.
Yeah, getting hit by thunder and lightning
or even when it's 30 degrees it's
that could be too much
to work
yeah.
under the tent and
and it's okay to take the week off, and just because you take the week off it doesn't mean no one will ever eat your food again.
Oh yeah
we always do it. Well, Phil always does a little kind of funny post Instagram thing to try and keep people interested, because there is always that fear that if you don't turn up then people will not turn up as well, but I think you're right. I don't think people are really that bothered about
it clearly hasn't hit your business by taking some time off sometimes.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I'm really happy that it's going so well.
Thank you.
I've eaten the food and I will eat the food again. It's all great. And yeah, nice to have something kind of different from what we consider to be like Italian cooking.
Yeah.
So now on to like my great passion, which is like, yeah, online dating, dating apps, because I have something in common with each of you in different ways, in that I am someone who dates men and women, as is Phil.
Yep.
And I am fat, as is Brad. And I thought it was kind of an interesting thing to talk to like people who have the same but different experiences as me of like the world of dating. How has it been for you on the old internet streets, Brad?
Where do we begin? It all began many years ago. No, I think for gay men, the internet was probably more prevalent maybe a decade before heterosexual dating.
And yeah.
It was always kind of probably the only acceptable way to try and find people that without going to bars and clubs and things like that. It was kind of much, much kind of ahead of the curve, if you like. But it's almost always been about purely sex. So it's not so much dating as it is just hooking up with people. So it's only really in recent times that it's become actually dating.
Yeah.
On the kind of same parity as straight heterosexual kind of dating apps and things. But yeah, to begin with, it was always a bit, I mean, being a big guy as well, I mean, the whole kind of gay culture is very much body kind of shaming and...
Yeah, that's what I'm really interested in, because, like, I've only ever been a woman, and, like, whatever experiences I've had of, like, dating as a fat woman have always been oriented around, like, being a woman. But then I guess the common denominator between, like, my experience and your experience is that we both date men, so like we are on the receiving end of like male bullshit.
It's yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a gay man and a straight woman share more than anyone else. I think for men it's easier and difficult in different ways, but yeah, very early on that you started getting communities on these apps, so people would separate off into the kind of archetypes. So you have bears and twinks and all these different kind of groups of people, which I'm not sure if that even exists in the straight kind of world of dating, but
definitely not in the same way.
No, not in the same way. But it kind of gives you a safe place to not worry about how you look and how you feel, and you see other people that are the same as you, and you start to kind of get more comfortable in your skin. So I think any kind of larger gay man, when they first start kind of exploring the world, they're very, very, very kind of, they have a lot of self-shame and stuff about their image. And it takes a good 10 years to kind of shake that off and realise you can have fun too.
Do you think it makes it easier to have, like, kind of image-based communities around which to gather? Or
yes,
do you think that
no.
makes it...
Yeah. I think it needed to happen to begin with when everything was quite kind of new and technology was new and everything. But it can be very damaging too. I mean, some of the people in those communities are pretty awful people and purely objectify.
Yeah.
So you just become a wobbly bit of flesh rather than a person that happens to be large. You are just a butt cheek or a or a roll or something. It's kind of...
You are so much more than a butt cheek, Brad.
You
have so much more to offer the world.
I hoped that would be the case. so the communities do get filled with the more dangerous side of kind of fetish, if you like, rather than the real kind of liking of somebody in whatever shape or form that they are. So, yeah, there's always that danger. And I think you can end up being locked in a kind of cycle of wanting that adoration, but then also feeling really shit because you're just literally an object to someone, and you just end up going down into a downward spiral of self-worth, kind of.
Yeah.
So it's easy to get stuck in that kind of situation. Yeah.
Would you say you've generally had, like, a fun time on the internet or, like...
I think to begin with, it was through necessity. So it was pretty much the only way to kind of meet people and have fun. I think I've learned to see it as a tool and not be so kind of hung up by it. And I'm using it less and less and less. I think as you get older, it gets a little bit less kind of focus of your brain the whole time. But I think it's improving. And I think at some point there'll be no difference between straight, gay, whatever. They'll all just merge. Like Tinder, I guess, is a good example of that.
Yeah, it's kind of a universal
app.
Yeah, because I always see Tinder like fundamentally as a kind of straight app, but I know so many queer people that use it. So I guess, yeah, in that way.
It does annoy me that there still is kind of a huge separation. There's gay apps and there's straight apps, and I don't think it should be that way.
And it feels like implicitly the gay apps are oriented more around like casual sex.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
But then maybe it's like Tinder is...
Tinder is too, but it's kind of just, it's hidden. So it's kind of, I think the thing about the gay apps is they don't hide. They don't try and say they're anything that they're not. They say exactly what they are. Whereas I think the straight ones, because they appeal to some kind of accepted normality within straight relationships, and there's all this kind of Faustian bargaining going on between people, and really when two people want to hook up, they still have to go through all the rituals of dating, even if they don't want to date. They just want to...
Oh, yeah, true.
That doesn't really happen with the gay world.
Okay, yeah,
you just get to
it.
But with straight couples, you have to go jump over all these hurdles. Even if the two of you just literally want to hook up for an hour, you still have to go on that date. You still have to eat that dinner. You still have to...
That's so true.
...compliment them. You still have to groom them in a way. And so the apps have to kind of meet that need. They have to kind of push that as the agenda, when really, actually, most of the people aren't interested in dating at all.
Yeah, that's true. And, like, I really felt... I found that. You're right. That's so true. I've sometimes just been like, I wish that there were more things like Grindr for like women, or like women of any sexual orientation.
The difficulty is though that if a woman does it, you're branded as a slut or something. It's kind of
it's and so you're unfairly disadvantaged
by doing, and of course the danger. But when you're male, it's not really even considered a bad thing to do to be promiscuous. It's
And I know that, like, that the lack of that kind of... the lack of that app is purely, like, a sociological thing rather than, like, an actual, like, biological thing. But, yeah, that's really interesting that, like, with the gay apps, you can just kind of be more upfront about what you want, and you don't have to jump through so many social hoops to get it. Whereas with the, like, dating apps in the straight world, it is more like you do have to, like, turn up, have the conversation...
And it's funny because you know that both the people are completely aware of what's going on, but they still kind of
like,
go through the motions.
I never take for granted that if I meet someone on an app that, like, we will have sex, even if, like, I don't know. I guess I'm just very like, they might not like me when they meet me, and then they won't want to, or like I need to reserve the right to like not want to as well if I change my mind.
I think that's different. I think the gay apps tend to be more implicit that if you're meeting, then you are meeting for sex. There's no kind of hidden agenda.
People really won't change
their
mind.
It's kind of a done deal.
Yeah, also, is it when you're in someone's house.
It's like,
because
so it's late. It's a whole dating thing.
So you don't, like, meet in public?
No, you don't meet in public places.
Oh, okay. So I guess that makes more sense.
I think unless you really want to see that film or... But of course, it could be dangerous too. It could be very dangerous. I mean, that's always
I would never go to someone's house on, like, someone that I'd never met before. Yeah. Like, I'd meet someone for a drink and then go back to their house on that night, but I wouldn't go straight to their house, I think.
I think that's right, but I think with gay men, I think there's always something that stops you fearing as much, I guess, as women. But the danger is still absolutely real, and people don't really... And there has been in the news people murdered, and
it's true.
Sorts of nasty things happen. I think the inner machismo makes you think, well, I'm a man, I can look after myself, or whatever. But actually, no, it's dangerous, I think, for anyone to...
Men are dangerous.
Whether they're dangerous to men or women, or otherwise. Yeah.
You just learn to recognise the weirdos right away.
There's usually very, very big alarm bells that
red
go off.
Flag.
Yeah.
And how have you found it, like, dating women as someone who dates men and women, and dating men as someone who dates men and women?
There are different I don't know, shades of it. Is, well, for women, I used basically almost just OkCupid or Tinder as well. But OkCupid is more like it gives you a it gives you more information about who you're talking to, and you kind of feel already safe talking about stuff, or if you know if you would like click or not with someone.
You have a reasonable idea on OkCupid as to whether you will have anything in common with this person. Whether or not you have like romantic or sexual chemistry with them is another thing, but you can probably at least have a conversation with them.
You don't have any of that in gay apps. There's no personality stuff whatsoever.
It's image based.
It was image and size. It's just size of everything you can imagine. It's size and what you look like, and that's it. There's nothing about what you enjoy, what type of person you are. Nothing.
That's it's very just, interesting to me.
Well, I guess then on the gay apps, if you're bisexual, it's, I mean, no, sometimes it's just, okay, they don't notice. Sometimes it's like a turn on, sometimes it's a turn off.
Yeah.
It's weird. So, I don't know, I've never made a big, it's never been a problem. But I also changed, I mean, there are loads of definitions about sexuality and how you identify yourself. And I wouldn't say, I discovered this definition was pansexual. Which I found more appealing to me. I felt it's been like a, especially since I moved to London, it's been like a trip on like discovering all these things, and I realized it was very, I had very strong ideas about some things, even gender or sexuality as well. But and I realized they weren't mine. You know, it was like very much about education and the society I grew up in, and now I realize how I was
conditioned,
like, in that in that kind of mind cage. So even talking about bisexuality, I mean, loads of my friends, I mean, don't know it, and I don't think it's a thing that you, why do you have to talk about it if it's not like the topic? I mean, if you're not talking actually about it, it's not coming, it's a different, it's different to come out, like, as, because it's not like,
I think it's
defined.
Harder for bisexual men than gay men. It's much more difficult to be recognized even as a thing. Most gay men will just assume that a bisexual person is just afraid of coming out. And
yeah, it feels like whether you're a man or a woman, if you're bi or whatever, the assumption is always that you will default to men, like that it's really always about men. That if you're a bi man, you're actually gay, and if you're a bi woman, you're actually straight, and that in the end, it all comes back to
always the man. That's the linchpin. You know, it's ridiculous. I mean, when I was younger, I had girlfriends, and I had sex with girls, and I enjoyed it. It wasn't like, oh my god, they're disgusting. Like, most gay men are kind of, so I understand attraction and finding different people attractive, and so I've never ever thought of bisexuality as some kind of mask, which most people do think it is. But I just think that there's no real representation of them, and bisexual people tend to have to always defend their bisexuality, whereas gay people are kind of given the right and ability to not have to defend it, and they just are.
I think that's very true.
Yeah, and also the thing that Brad was talking about, the size thing, is it's a weird kind of thing, especially, well, men who like bigger women or men, they usually, it's usually a fetish. So so in the gay community, someone likes bigger guys is a chaser.
Yeah.
And I don't like,
I don't like, no one's chasing me.
I don't like that definition. I mean, I definitely don't identify with it, because usually, as he was saying, someone who sees a body
Yeah.
It's really creepy. The whole language, the way that they talk to you, even though if you're a complete stranger, most of the time they just open, their opening kind of gambit is, how much do you weigh?
Oh my God.
Not even hello, how are you?
Yeah.
Just...
Yeah, he shows me some messages.
Have you eaten today?
I think
WTF?
I think with like fetishization, the way that you can kind of tell if it's happening is like, could that person like have any interest in you if you did not look the way you look?
Exactly.
And I can always tell. Like, I can always tell with like how, and it's always, you know, in my kind of sexual romantic history, it's always been men, how men deal with you, and you can tell which are like just fancy you and like maybe have a preference for your body type, and which are like wouldn't have any interest in you if you had a different body or look slightly different, and they deal with you in completely different ways.
Totally different language, different approach. I mean, it's what made me kind of fall for Phil, really, is that I didn't feel at any point that it was about my size or body. It was just,
you're a cool dude, and why wouldn't he? That's... Yeah.
So it kind of, I felt like I was talking to another human rather than just a dick, if you like.
Yeah. Someone that saw you purely as like a sexual object.
Yeah. But still made me feel kind of desired.
Yeah.
But not because of just that one thing.
It just sweetens the deal.
Exactly. It's just the cherry on top.
On what Brad and I were talking about how like when you meet men on an app, you tend to just like go straight to their home, cut out all the like social context. Have you found that that's the case, as opposed to like when you meet women on apps or sites or whatever, like you feel like you have to meet them in a public place and you have to do all that?
Well, statistically, it's more like, I mean, I did date men and met them like before, like socially. It's not a thing I don't do. I mean, if they are interesting people to talk to, it's actually better. You kind of opens the door to a different level of connection. With women, it's definitely there is a statistically, so it's more about the pre-sex, and you go on a date or you have a drink or a dinner, but I did met women as well in like straight away,
purely sexual contact.
It happened. It's rarer than men, but I don't know, but I would, if I was a woman, I would do the same.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I wish I felt safe enough to do that.
I would do the same.
It saddens me that there's always this kind of tiny spark of shame with women.
Yeah.
That they have to do all this stuff to not appear like a slut or a whatever other nasty word that is generally used. But it's like they're going through the motions because they have to.
Yeah.
And they really don't want to. But
for me as well, it was like, because I'm fat, and even though like I'm cool with that, I know that a lot of men, especially men, aren't. So I never want to put myself in a situation where like someone has to like reject me outright when we are in a situation where we're going to have sex. So I'd rather meet someone in like a public place and give them ample opportunity to like not have sex with me, so that when we do, I know that it's like, because we understand what's going to happen now. Like, no one has been catfished here. But yeah, like, I thought it was really funny that like, we spent quite like a long time together on our first date.
Yeah.
And then I was like, well, I'm going to get the bus now. Bye. And then all of a sudden I was like, you could get the bus with me if you want, like to my home. Yeah. And because you just did not give any indication that you were in any way interested in me.
I'm a poker face.
Yeah. It was like totally like, I have no idea what he's going to say, so I'm just going to see what happens. But yeah, like, I really had no idea if you were interested in me in any way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
I'm sorry.
Because obviously, like,
I definitely was. Yeah. I definitely was.
Maybe.
But yeah, like, I just thought that was really funny that normally I can tell, like, if someone is interested. But with you, I was just like, I have no idea.
He's so a very just... hard person to read.
Yeah.
Really, really difficult.
Does this resonate with you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
No, everyone says it.
Well, it's, I think with him, it's a very strange mix of Italian culture, which is very kind of machismo, if you like. It's kind of very macho and male kind of dominated. But also, being from a very small place, in a very isolated place, he's actually more British than Italian in many ways. He's very kind of reserved and unemotional. But it's all there. You just need to read the very subtle signs.
They're all way too subtle.
Yeah. Plus, I think also when he met you, he hadn't been here that long, I don't think.
And, maybe
and
not.
No.
He hadn't really acclimatized to kind of our very strange things that we do in this country and our strange behaviour. And when you are with somebody who is not from the place that you're from, you soon very kind of quickly learn that there are some very weird things that we do culturally.
Like signals and signs.
Yeah, and like the whole saying sorry for everything. Like to other people, it just seems remarkable that you're just constantly saying sorry. Sorry you walked into me. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Like, sorry kind of you dropped your drink.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, I'm so sorry I got in the way of your life today. so there's all these kind of cultural kind of things come to a head, and you have to slowly learn each other's signs and symbols of feelings and emotions.
Yeah, I don't think that I'm very Italian in that way.
No,
I mean, I'm not straightforward. I'm not. I don't like to be like invasive with what I want. I mean, if I want something, it might be a bit harder to tell if I want it or not. But I kind of learned that. I'm learning. I'm working on it because I know everybody says I'm hard to read.
You need an enigma machine.
But it's definitely, as you said, the place where I come from, it makes me say that I'm from Italy, but I'm not Italian in many ways. I'm not.
Well, I have really enjoyed this conversation.
Are we done?
Thank you so much.
Wow,
seriously?
Yeah.
No way.
Time has flown by. So if you want to follow either of you, where can you be found online? Phil?
Well, I'm on Instagram mostly at Phil Mara, FILMARRA. And Brad is...
And I'm on Instagram too. Brad Clark UK, BRADCLARK UK.
And our business, it's Sorry Not Sorry London.
On all of them.
Instagram and Facebook. And we are arguing about Twitter because I don't want to use it.
Maybe I can do your Twitter.
Yeah, I was thinking yesterday, if I had like some more money, I would hire you.
Well, we can come to an arrangement. And you can be found at Brick Lane Markets on Sundays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Sorry Not Sorry.
Yeah, if you change your mind, if you have like updates, you just follow us and
you'll
we'll let
be
you
able
know.
To see
yep.
where
Instagram's
you're
the main kind of point of contact, I think.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I have really enjoyed this conversation.
Me too.
Me too.
Thank you
Me
so
three.
Much for coming.
Thank you.
I will be back next week for the penultimate episode of season one of Hello Friend, and I will see you there. Thanks very much. Bye.
Bye.